I got to thinking about movies and television and how things often work. A lot of times when there's a hero in the story, there's a sidekick that kind of helps them out. Maybe the sidekick saves the day, but it seems like there's always that point guy who gets all the glory. Several years ago, I was kind of thinking about what would it be like if all the sidekicks got together and had a support group to kind of work through what it was like trying to work with a superstar and live in that shadow. And so I like to play around with pictures and Photoshop and things. So I created a picture. Take a look at this. Okay, so this is a sidekick support group. Now, it's a little bit dated now, okay? But let's just kind of work our way around. I'm going to say the name of the sidekick, and you tell me who he goes along with, okay? We'll start down here in the bottom corner with Barney Fife. Sheriff Andy Griffith. There you go. Okay, Barney Rubble. Fred Flintstone. Al Borland. Tim the Tool Man Taylor, okay? Chewbacca, Han Solo. I would have accepted Luke Skywalker. They were friends, but you were exactly right, Han Solo. Robin, Batman. Here we go. We're going way back now. Ethel Mertz, Lucy Ricardo, right, in that show, okay, because she had a couple different shows. Then Tonto, the Lone Ranger. Okay, I spent way too much time on that picture, okay? But I like the concept because it has to be hard to play second fiddle, right? We're continuing our series today. It's actually called Second String because in sports, you have first string. They're the starters, and then you have second string. In the orchestra, yeah, there's first chair, but there's second chair, third chair, fourth chair, and on. We're going to talk about King David today. King David did not grow up second string or second fiddle. He was actually eighth fiddle. Because he had seven older brothers. And so he was always the last one in line. I heard about a mom who was showing pictures to a little boy of his three older brothers, school pictures, and he says, hey, those guys are wearing my clothes. Well, you know, that's how David felt, man. All of his clothes were hand-me-downs from his older brothers. All the toys he got were leftover discarded toys from his older brothers. He always got the heel at the end of the loaf of bread. You know, I mean, he was just that kid. As a young adult, David had to play second fiddle or maybe second harp to King Saul. David had been anointed as the successor to the throne in Israel. He was going to be king, but it was going to take him years to get there. See, David knew what it was like to be second. He knew what it was like to live in the shadow of somebody else. But that's really not what we're going to talk about today. Because, see, David didn't live in the shadow forever. He became a starter. He became the prominent guy. Today, we're going to meet a friend of David's who lived in David's shadow. See, Saul, the king, had a son named Jonathan. Jonathan spent most of his life as the prince in the palace. And yet, he ended up being second to David in nearly every category that mattered. David became a starter. Jonathan came in off the bench. Jonathan was David's sidekick, and he was completely fine with that. He lived in David's shadow, but he was willing to put himself second to David. Now, over in the New Testament, the book of Romans chapter 12, verse 15 says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. The Message version of the Bible says, laugh with your happy friends, share tears when your friends are down. Now, would you agree with me that sometimes it's easier to share tears when your friend is in pain than to share their success? Now, don't get me wrong. It's not that we delight in their failure or we want things to go badly for them. But sometimes when something great happens to somebody else or they get the break that you had hoped that you would get, sometimes it can be hard to take. Philip Gully is a pastor from Indianapolis that I like to read some of his books. He started one of the chapters in his book, Front Porch Tales, by saying, a friend of mine, Jim, is a minister. He wears a big cross. He gives a wad of money away every year. He is devout. He is smart. His children are gifted, and his wife mows the lawn. Naturally, I despise him. Now, I think he's joking about that, but you kind of get the idea. You know what he's talking about. Most of us probably know somebody, maybe a person we love, but deep down, there's kind of a twinge of jealousy there. Maybe they have something that we wish we had. Maybe they are something that we wish we were. Maybe they can do something we wish we could do. Maybe they've achieved something we wish that we could achieve. And I'm guessing that everybody knows somebody like that. And I wonder, why do we feel the way that we do? I think the answer that we would prefer to give is that, well, we're just competitive. You know, and in games, in sports, we push ourselves to excel. We want to come out on top. We want to be winners. There's nothing wrong with that as long as you play fair and you're a good sport. The problem comes when we take that same spirit of competition and we bring it into relationships and we start competing for attention and we compete for possessions and we compete for love and for affection. And in the process, we start walking over people to get what we want. We don't just want good kids. We want better kids than you have. We don't just want success. We want success at the expense of everybody else. I heard a guy named Jeff Walling speak at a retreat one time. And he said in the corporate world, often, not always, but often, in the corporate world, the attitude is, I can't win unless you lose. I can't win unless you lose. But he said in the church, the attitude ought to be, I can't win if you lose. Because we're all in this together. There's a spirit of unity here. We're in relationship. We're one team. But sometimes that's hard. A competitive nature can drive a wedge in friendships if we aren't careful. But let me be really honest with you. I think a darker reason we often struggle with this, even beyond competition, is just plain old envy. We want what other people have. And we will not be content until we have it, even if the other person is a close friend or a family member. The only time I ever remember disliking my brother was when I was 12 and he was 16, and I adored his girlfriend. How could he have her? Because I wanted her. Listen, maturity comes in relationships when we can celebrate our friends' victories rather than resenting them. We can be happy about their success instead of being envious for what they've achieved. In fact, I would go so far as to say that we should be our best friend's biggest fan. Think what that would do to relationships. That's my bottom line today. Just real simple. Be your best friend's biggest fan. Rejoice with those who rejoice, the Bible says. Laugh with your happy friends. Now, if you know much at all about King Saul in the Bible, you know that he was Israel's first king. But because of his disobedience, God raised up David to take over in Saul's place. Once David killed the giant Goliath, the trajectory of his life completely changed. I mean, Saul was still on the throne, but David's star was rising and everything was going great for him. Saul invited David to come to the palace, took an instant liking to him. But the Bible says that David found success everywhere that he went. And so what happened is that Saul became jealous of David. David rose in prominence in the army, had victory after victory. So there was this jealousy. And you wonder, how intense was the jealousy? Well, one time, actually multiple times, Saul would be listening to David play the harp, and all of a sudden he would get angry, and he would hurl a spear at David, trying to skewer him like a shish kebab. This is a toxic work environment, we would call that. This guy's throwing spears. Now, we don't know exactly when Saul figured out that David was the guy who was going to be his successor as king. We don't know exactly when David and Jonathan became friends. What we know is that the prophet Samuel came to David to anoint him as king when he was a young man. We know that God told Saul through Samuel that Saul would not get to have his son be his successor, but that somebody else was going to take over the throne. And so at some point, Father Saul and son Jonathan figured out that friend David was the one who was going to be the next king. And we know that Saul was not happy about it. Now I want you to imagine, you're Jonathan. Man, you are the son of the king. You are in line to be the next king. And then you find out that God has somebody else in mind. How do you feel about that guy? I mean, what does that do to you? Well, let's back up into 1 Samuel chapter 18 And let's see how Jonathan felt. Beginning in verse 1. After David had finished talking with Saul, he met Jonathan, the king's son. There was an immediate bond of love between them, and they became the best of friends. From that day on, Saul kept David with him and would not let him return home. And Jonathan made a solemn pact with David because he loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan sealed the pact by taking off his robe and giving it to David, together with his tunic, his sword, his bow, and his belt. See, sometime after David killed Goliath, he and Jonathan became friends. And not just common friends, they became the best of friends. This was not like a casual companionship. There was a deep bond of love here. Now, some people have gone so far as to say that David and Jonathan shared a homosexual relationship. And later on, we're going to see where it says that David said that Jonathan's love was better than the love of a woman. But there's nothing in this text that ever suggests anything sexual at all. They were best friends. They were soulmates. They were blood brothers. We don't have to read any more into it than that. The Bible does not suggest that. What it suggests is an extraordinary friendship. And in the process, Jonathan became David's biggest fan. That's what best friends do. In fact, when he gave David his robe, his sword, his bow, and his belt, Jonathan was showing deep respect for David. He was proving that he recognized David's leadership over him. He was acknowledging that David would surpass him and take over the throne. And this was a dramatic, powerful statement that Jonathan was making. It would be like Tiger Woods giving his golf clubs to Brooks Koepka and saying, "You are now the number one golfer in the world. I surrender my position to you." It would be like Michael Phelps giving his Speedo, no, that's creepy, giving his swim cap to Caleb Dressel and saying, "You are now the fastest swimmer in the world." Man, Jonathan was in line to be king, but he willingly relinquished his position to David. And the truth is, Saul did not like that one bit. He was like some of those dads at the ball games who just go off on the coach because they're not playing their son enough. Only this was a lot more serious than that. David became convinced that King Saul would do anything to keep him from becoming king and having Jonathan be king instead. And so David told Jonathan, "Look, your dad wants me dead." And Jonathan just couldn't believe it. That's just not possible. And so David said, "Look, I'll prove it to you. I'm going to lay low for a few days, kind of drop out of sight. And when your dad asks about me, you tell him that I went to Bethlehem for a visit. And let's see how he reacts. If he reacts and says, 'Oh, no problem, that David, what a guy,' well, then maybe I was wrong. But if he blows up in some way, I think you'll know how he really feels about me." So that's what happened. David missed a few meals. One night at dinner, Saul asked Jonathan where David was. Jonathan said, "Oh, David went to Bethlehem." And look what it says in 1 Samuel 20, verse 30. Saul boiled with rage at Jonathan. "You stupid son of a whore," he swore at him. "Do you think I don't know that you want him to be king in your place, shaming yourself and your mother? As long as that son of Jesse is alive, you will never be king. Now go get him so I can kill him." "But why should he be put to death?" Jonathan asked his father. "What has he done?" Then Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan, intending to kill him. So at last Jonathan realized that his father was really determined to kill David. Man, would somebody take that spear away from Saul? What's he doing with it at the dinner table? Right? It's all fun and games till somebody gets an eye out. Listen, Saul is out of control. Man, Jonathan knows now that his dad is insane with anger. And so he's forced to make a tough decision. And listen, it was a tough decision. Does he go along with his dad? Does he get rid of David? Does he take the throne back? Or does he defy his father, protect David, and honor their friendship? The next morning, Jonathan says he's going to go out and do a little target practice, bow and arrow, but he secretly wants to meet with David, who's still in hiding. 1 Samuel 20, verse 40. Jonathan gave his bow and arrows to the boy and told him to take them back to town. And as soon as the boy was gone, David came out from where he had been hiding near the stone pile. And David bowed 3 times to Jonathan with his face to the ground. And both of them were in tears as they embraced each other and said goodbye, but especially David. At last, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn loyalty to each other in the Lord's name. The Lord is the witness of a bond between us and our children forever." And then David left, and Jonathan returned to town. Life would never be the same for David after this, or for Jonathan for that matter. David spent the next years of his life on the run. He's hiding from Saul. But through all of that, man, Jonathan stayed true to his covenant, and he honored his devoted friend and ally. This close relationship they'd had at the palace was over. But man, their friendship and the loyalty of that relationship never ended. In fact, 1 Samuel 23:15 says this: "While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph," he's having to hide out from Saul, "he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. 'Don't be afraid,' he said. 'My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel.'" Listen to this. "You'll be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David returned to Horesh. "You will be king, and I will be second to you." How do you think those words tasted to Jonathan? You know, I'm going to guess not so bad. Not because he was afraid to be king, not because he didn't want to be king. It's because he loved David so much, and he respected David so much, and he believed in David so much. He was David's biggest fan. Now, did Jonathan grow up dreaming of being king? Maybe. I mean, probably. We don't know. But when it became clear that God wanted David to be king instead, Jonathan was okay with that. In fact, he was more than okay with it. He embraced David's leadership. And that can be tough to do, but it's the right thing to do. Be your best friend's biggest fan. Now, the truth is, that's harder to do when their victory could be yours or could have been yours. Now, this is not really anything, there's nothing you can do about this. I just want to make an observation here. This is kind of a heads up for you if you struggle with this at all. It is easier, I have found, to celebrate your friend's success when they excel in areas that are totally outside your area of involvement. Does that make sense? I mean, come on, it's just easier. I have lots of friends who are great golfers, they're great singers, great artists, great musicians, and man, I have no problem celebrating their success because I'm lousy at those things. I don't have any trouble with that at all. But sometimes I'm tempted to envy my friend's basketball skills or their photography talent or their deer hunting ability or their teaching ability, because those are things I like to do and things I wish I could do better. It's harder to rejoice over your friend's victory when what they are victorious in is something that you wish was yours. Back when we lived in Indiana, I participated several times in what they call a triathlon sprint. It's a half-mile swim, an 18-mile bike ride, and a 3-mile run. Now, I always participated on a team because I hate swimming, and even though I wanted to do the whole thing, I always thought, I hate to drown in front of the whole town. It would be embarrassing, you know? And so I just couldn't do the whole thing. And so for 2 or 3 years, I did a team deal. I was the bike rider, and we had a runner and a swimmer. The last year before we moved away, I biked and ran, and Gail did the swim. So that was pretty cool for us to do that together. It was a neat thing. But the years that I did only the bike, I trained with a friend of mine named Glenn. Glenn's about 10 years older than I am. He's in far better shape than I am. He's a marathon runner and stuff. And he was going to do the whole thing. He was going to swim, bike, and run. And the way the triathlon works, if you're on a team, is that the swimmers all go out first, and they have a little ankle bracelet thingy that kind of keeps the time. And when they come back across a certain line, if you're on a team, they have to give you that little ankle bracelet. You put it on your ankle, and then you wear it for the bike. And then when you're done with that, you trade again, and the person doing the run wears it for that. So here's Glenn, one of my very best friends in the world. And when he took off on his swim, man, I was right there on the dock with everybody else cheering him on. Go, Glenn. I was so excited for Glenn. And when he crossed the finish line at the run at the end of the thing, I'm right there at the finish line cheering him on. Way to go, Glenn. And that was easy because I wasn't swimming and I wasn't running. But when I was on my bike, I looked over my shoulder for 18 miles. whenever anybody would pass me, which was often, I would click, you know, kind of quick glance over to see who it was, praying that it would not be Glenn. Because, I mean, come on. I'm just scared to death the guy's going to pass me on the bike. He's already swimming a half mile and running 3 miles, which I'm not having to do. I don't want him to beat me on the bike. And so the whole time, I'm thinking, here's this guy. He's older than I am, and I don't want him to pass me. The only person I wanted to beat was him. I didn't care about anybody else. Because it's easy to cheer for people in events that you're not involved with, but I didn't want him to make me look bad in the one thing I was doing. Does that make sense? I'm just saying it's a little bit harder to celebrate your friend's victory when they're achieving something you wish you had achieved. So you have to be careful. It's why, listen, it's why Jonathan's love is so impressive for David. He was not just the best friend of the king. I mean, that'd be cool. He was the best friend of the guy who was king instead of him. That's impressive. That takes a certain kind of man. So be your best friend's biggest fan. Now, let's face it, that's easier to do when they don't gloat or act superior. Okay? This is just a word for you superstars out there who make the rest of us look bad. Don't gloat or act superior, not if you want us to still like you. Okay? I'm sure that if Glenn had passed me on the bike, he would have high-fived me as we went by. He would have told me how good I looked, how fit I looked. Wasn't I doing a great job as he sailed on by? That's what he would have done because we have that kind of relationship. He would have tried to make me feel better about myself, even though at that very moment I was hating his guts in Christian love. You know what I'm saying, okay? The only two people I passed looked like they needed to be airlifted to the hospital, so I got nothing to brag about, but I did it, okay? I finished. But Glenn would have supported me. Listen, the Bible never says that David acted superior to Jonathan. We never have any indication that he reminded Jonathan, remember, Samuel anointed me to be king, not you. He never told Jonathan to stay out of his way. We never have any sense at all that he treated Jonathan like the no good son of the guy that wants me dead. I mean, none of that. They loved each other. There was a bond that was stronger than who was whose son or who was what rank in the army or who was next up to be king. So be your best friend's biggest fan. Now that's important, especially when you feel like you deserve what they've got. I mean, let's face it. This is part of unconditional love. Your spouse gets a raise and you get laid off. Your friend makes the ball team and you get cut. Your roommate gets a scholarship and you have to get a loan. Your coworker gets a promotion and you stay put. Your sister marries a guy with a Bill Gates bank account and a Bradley Cooper smile and you don't. Love celebrates the success of other people. 1 Corinthians 13:4 says love is patient. That's what Sam reminded us of this morning. Love is kind. Does not envy, does not boast, it's not proud, it's not rude, it's not self-seeking. Love does not envy, it's not self-seeking. Be happy with those who are happy. Be your best friend's biggest fan. Now, you know when that's really fulfilling? It's fulfilling when you decide that your friendship is the higher priority than whatever it is you're competing in. See, I'm telling you, when you come to the conclusion that your friendship means more, it's more valuable than whatever that thing is that you want to envy in them, you're going to be just so much happier. Your life's going to be so much better. When you decide the relationship is more precious to you than whatever achievement it is that you didn't achieve or whatever talent it is that you don't possess, when life and love and friendship and relationships, man, they will mean more to you when you realize they're more important than all the stuff that we get so enamored by. I cannot get this line in Scripture out of my head. You will be king and I will be second to you. Man, you know, I don't know what kind of position you hold, what your title is, what career you've retired from. Maybe you're a student still. Maybe you're a teacher, a coach. Maybe you're a mom or dad or grandma or grandpa, son or daughter. Maybe you're the CEO of the company. Maybe you are a mailroom delivery consultant. Everybody's important. I really believe that. But you know what? Nobody in this room is in line to be king. Sorry. Nobody. Oh, you might be king of your castle at home, at least in your own mind, but you're not going to be king of the whole dang country. You know what I mean? You're not king over millions of people. You are not king over God's chosen people. Jonathan was in line to be the most powerful man in the nation. And when he found out somebody else was getting the job, he said, okay. When he found out that his best friend got the job, he became his best friend's biggest fan. And that's impressive. It's so impressive to David that later when Jonathan died, David adopted Jonathan's disabled son, Mephibosheth. David's the king, and now sitting at his table for every meal is the son of the man who could have been his greatest adversary, but instead was his biggest fan. So let me ask you something. Why does all this matter? I mean, seriously, we're a church, and we're talking about how to be a good friend. I mean, aren't there more important things? Maybe. But loyalty in relationships is one key to spiritual maturity. The New Testament stresses that we're not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought to. The New Testament says that we're not to be proud, that we are always to look out for the best interest of other people. And I was thinking about John the Baptist in the New Testament. There was a time when John the Baptist was all the rage, and everybody was coming to hear him. Everybody was flocking to be baptized by John the Baptist. Everybody wanted to go to him for spiritual guidance. And then Jesus shows up on the scene, and John's followers start following Jesus. And some of John's closest disciples kind of start to freak out a little bit, and they get worried because they're losing their constituency. And you remember what John said? What did John say about Jesus when all these people start following Jesus instead of him? He said, he must increase and I must decrease. Jesus must increase and I must decrease. What an amazing attitude. John willingly stepped into Jesus' shadow. Now, did that make John insignificant? Not at all. He did what God called him to do, and Jesus later said, of those born of women, nobody's ever been more influential than John. John chose to play second fiddle. He chose to be second string, and he played his part extremely well. Now, you contrast John the Baptist with the Pharisees in Jesus' day. When Jesus started getting all this attention, they thought they deserved the attention, and so the Pharisees began to whine, oh, the whole world's going after him, boo-hoo. And they're nervous, and then they're jealous, and then they're frustrated, and then they're outraged. And they killed him, not because they denied his miracles. They killed him because they couldn't stand to walk in his shadow. Friends, loyalty remains one of the keys to spiritual maturity. Jesus must increase, we must decrease. You know, one of my favorite bands, Christian bands, is Casting Crowns. They've been around forever. We've done a lot of their music here over the years. Well, the whole concept of casting crowns comes from the idea that we cast before Jesus. We shower Jesus with all of our accolades, all of our achievements, all of our trophies. We kind of give all that to him, lay it at his feet. There's an old hymn, Holy, Holy, Holy. It speaks of casting down our golden crowns before Jesus. There's an old chorus we used to sing in church, We Bow Down, that says, we bow down, we lay our crowns at the feet of Jesus. He must increase, we must decrease. And that's kind of our attitude in relationships too. Man, Jesus deserves our loyalty. And you think about it, he said in John 15, greater love has no one than this, but that a man lay down his life for his friends. And so that's what he did for us. He called us friends, and he laid down his life for us. It just doesn't get any more loyal than that. So this seems important to me. Being your best friend's biggest fan is not some cliche. It's not pop psychology. It's being like Jesus. And being like Jesus is what we're here for. Jonathan was David's biggest fan. And I have a feeling David was his. That's why when Jonathan was killed in battle, David sang this song of lament in 2 Samuel chapter 1. Oh, how the mighty heroes have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies dead on the hills. How I weep for you, my brother Jonathan. How much I loved you. Your love for me was deep, deeper than the love of women. how the mighty heroes have fallen. David lost his best friend. He lost his biggest fan. And despite the fact that he was rising as the king in Israel, it broke his heart. You know, I mentioned Philip Goley earlier, the author and preacher. And he wrote another story about a friend of his named Tim. He said, I met Tim in the second grade. We sat together in Ms. Worrell's class. We became friends when we discovered that no other group would have us. We weren't athletic enough to be jocks. And the girls didn't like us because we looked funny. Even the Boy Scouts, who took a solemn oath to be kind and charitable, steered clear of us. He said, Tim lived on a farm and I lived in town. We hit fourth grade. Our parents let us ride bikes back and forth to each other's houses. Our social life increased exponentially. On Fridays, we'd go to the movies up at the Royal Rat Hole, as we called it. The jocks would sit near the back and neck with the girls, and we'd sit behind them and make kissing noises. When we were in eighth grade, I invited a girl named Amy to the spring dance. Tim came along with us. We wore plaid leisure suits and drank a lot of punch. Amy spent most of her time in the bathroom. Then we went to high school. We took all the same classes so we could be together. We were both girl crazy. Unfortunately, our feelings were not reciprocated. The prettiest girl in school was named Laura. She was a cheerleader. Tim loved her. She was a friend of my brother's who was a jock, so I asked her for her picture. She signed it to someone I really admire, I think because she didn't remember my name. I sold it to Tim for $2. Friendship has its limits. But man, did you have a friend like that? Just did everything together? Gully went on in his chapter to say this. One night about 2 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call from the sheriff's chaplain. He told me my best friend since Ms. Worrell's second grade class had been hit by a drunk driver and was dead. Tim's funeral was 3 days later. I was a pallbearer. I sat on the front row. His parents sat across from me. We buried him at the South Cemetery, and all I remember now is the crying. Philip Goley wrote this story, his friend Jonathan, as a young man that he lost. King David lost his best friend Jonathan as a young man, a friend who stood by him through thick and thin. And it just makes me want to say, man, maybe you've got a friend that you're a little bit tempted to envy. Or maybe you have a friend who's a little bit tempted to envy you. And man, the deal is life is too short to be petty. Life is too short to allow stupid, insignificant things come between our relationships with people we love. Be happy with those who are happy. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Be your best friend's biggest fan.